Hey folks, just a quick note for the podcast listeners. Welcome. This introduction that you're about to listen to is to a series that I've started this week on doubt. It's a bit longer. It includes some material about a current news story, the story of the discovery of the mass graves of Indigenous children at the Kamloops Residential School. So if that's a triggering story for you, just a heads up about that. And we do spend some time together. It's a longer podcast. We do spend some time together in it, considering that story and being silent with it, among other things. And that's included in this podcast. So respond as you need to for your own sense of safety and well-being. But just don't want you to be waiting in there blithely. All right. Again, thanks for joining us for the podcast. And I hope this is able to free something in your spirit and in your life as you listen. Here we go. Welcome. Wow. You know, acknowledging my gratitude for being welcomed here by the peoples that were here long before settlers arrived feels important. It feels important to me to do that. I think it's important as part of the process of naming the truth. Zach, you were, I think, so right and wise to point out that this is a story in a time, a season in general, in which First Nations and Indigenous voices need to be centered. If this place of privilege that I still enjoy in this culture as a person of settler heritage means that I can push those voices upward in any way from wherever I sit, then I want to do that. And that's part of why I would stop to acknowledge where we are. We're starting a series on doubt. More about that in a moment. Much more. But, you know, if you grew up being taught that your church was right about everything, I don't see how you could possibly encounter a story about the church, the Christian church, behaving the way it did on this continent in many instances, but egregiously through the residential schools. I don't know how you can encounter a story like that and not doubt a teaching like that one I just mentioned. And then what to do, right? A mass grave is a crime scene. Among the other stories that came out this week were stories of from people who were at that school talking about how as children, there were rumors among the children of a hidden graveyard. There was an orchard, maybe it was in the orchard, but nobody really knew if those stories were true or if that graveyard existed. 215 children, identified in volume, if you will, as the number of people in that mass grave. There are 51 recorded deaths at that school over the time it operated. That means that the religion that I grew up in gave an awful lot of energy to two horrific things, at least. One of which was murder. The other of which was duplicity, was hiding murder, concealing the crime. At the same time that institution was conducting elaborate funerals for individuals within the institution who passed on. Would I begrudge any of those people who died their funeral? Of course not. That's not the point. The point is that acknowledgement of the value of life, the nurturance of each life, the cherishing of it, the furtherance of it, the collective acknowledgement of its physical end, the opportunity to grieve as a community. These are all things that were denied in a massive, systematic, ongoing, religiously justified way. Does it make you doubt anything you were ever taught? It does me. And so that's a thing to that we can learn about and work on, and that can equip us to be fuller participants in a process in a moment like this. That's a rather long land acknowledgement. It's not rote. So this is all connected. I want us to, in our breathing together today, breathe however you want. We're going to take a literal minute this morning, one whole minute from our lives, you know, and we're going to take that time to remember those that are closest to this loss, those that are alive, that are grief-stricken again at this, re-traumatized again by this, and at the same time to hold some space for those in our community who will feel this most acutely and experience it in ways that many of us can just simply never know. All right. I will let us know when our time to be silent is done collectively. If that silence is something you want or need to continue, I would encourage you to do that if you're able and as you're able. All right. But for now, let's take this minute together and hold space for things grievous today. All right. Here we go. Peace, everyone. Thank you. That's a hard space to begin in, isn't it? I don't say that with any sense of apology, but rather with a sense of acknowledgement. I believe that it's vital that we not look away from moments like this, because as long as we keep averting our eyes, averting our minds, averting our lives, things won't change. And they need to change. I'm going to shift spaces now a bit and move into an introduction to this examination of doubt that I would like us to spend some time in. When I was working on this a little bit, I was thinking, you know, it's spring, there's some stirring of hope as we watch other places in the country and in the world reopen and people be able to be back together again, and to feel those stirrings at the same time as we are as a province and as a city you know, still very much wrestling with some acute stage of this pandemic. That's a difficult space. And so Tim, why don't you just do something that's like really bright and cheery and filled with the colors of hope and of spring and emerging summer things, you know, some topic or topics that feel like the way the growing world outside the window looks right now. This is doubt, as we will examine in our and explore is a topic that often feels like it kind of goes with the dark emotions or the negative emotions or, you know, something like that. And I hope to help us turn the corner into a very different space in how we think about doubt over the course of these next weeks. But I want to acknowledge that right out of the chute. This could feel like, you know, like let's not do something gray when we're already facing, you know, dark gray. Let's do something in the primary colors. We're headed there, but I don't want to skip the work either. So, in any case, most of you know that I am bad at real math, but I'm pretty good at what one of my siblings calls cowboy math, by which I understand him to mean potentially helpful, but not necessarily numerically precise estimates. You know, now Kareen, who can do actual math and do it rather well, Kareen might not agree with my self-assessment that I'm good at cowboy math. She might arguably correctly observe that I am just bad at every kind of math, including this one. In fact, most people who can do real math might share that view, but I'm just going to go out on a limb here, and I am going to be math vulnerable. I am working with the assumption that my being loved does not depend on my ability to add, you know, either at home or at the table. So here's what I've been calculating. In very round numbers, I have been at the table for about 10 years. If you, it's a bit on the low side, we'll be coming up on more than that. But if you feel like you need a more precise number, ask Tim and Jane, because I've been around the table at about the same length of time as they've been married. So there's a nice, you know, happy benchmark for my math lazy brain. Plus, 10 is a very tidy number to work with. And so 10 it shall be. Average year has 52 weeks in it, so let's say 52 Sundays, although that's, again, we're sort of, you know, fudging things just a little bit. But for the purposes of my estimate, let's say 52 talkie bits, okay? Now, let's say I take some holidays with my family each year, and there's some other good folks in our community take a talkie bit sometimes. So let's just say I do 45 talkie bits a year, all right? So that's 450 talkie bits in the last 10 years. Now, No wonder Rosa finds the sound of this, you know, soothing. That's a lot of repetition. How that number sounds to you might depend at least somewhat on how often you've personally sat down in front of a blank screen and had to ask yourself, where am I headed this week? And is where I'm headed anywhere that anybody else would care to go? Some folks who do jobs like this, who speak to communities regularly, in a religious setting, if you will. Some of those folks follow a lectionary, so for better or worse, they might have some starting points dictated to them. There are some folks who like to lay things out far in advance, plans that stretch out a year or even 5 years. In the case of a church that one person close to me grew up in, 15 years. It's a long plan. I get tired just thinking about that idea, honestly, and I also start to feel preemptively bored. It's just kind of like, really? Some people, of course, fast and pray, and they count on the mystery they might call the Holy Spirit to dictate the topic. And frankly, that has some appeal, not least of all because then if people are pissed off at the topic, you can blame it on God, right? Like, you can just say things like, you know, don't touch the Lord's anointed and kind of get away with it. Well, in the interest of honest disclosure, I don't do any of those things. And again, with the caveat for better or for worse, my practice is a combination of watching and waiting. The watching part is mostly about trying to pay attention to what's going on around me. What's pressing in on people? What's happening in the dynamics between people, between us and the planet that's our home, kind of for us collectively as a species? I'm watching to see if there are cultural themes that keep recurring. I'm watching to see if there are ways in which there are particular big human questions that feel like they're coalescing around certain ideas or certain forms at this point in history. For me, that part is really quite interesting. It's even fun because I find culture fascinating, and being a culture watcher is something that tends to stir up things like alertness and attentiveness and energy in me. The waiting part is harder. I've learned to not panic, mostly, Or even to be especially anxious when ideas are late breaking or they feel like they won't quite settle down into something that can be meaningfully explored in our setting and time frame. Our mission as a community, the exploration of what we believe, that feels to me like such a warmly invitational and generous mission that I don't see why we would ever run out of material. I just think we're surrounded. I do think there are some ways in which we explore this that are unique to us as a community, or at least within my knowledge, unique to us as a community. Having said that, I don't think that the questions are necessarily unique in general. I think we're often asking the questions that many people are asking. To me, it feels more as though we are always surrounded by everything that we need by way of beliefs to explore. But sometimes we need to be patient when it comes to choosing what we'll focus on. We need to watch and pay attention, and we need to wait a bit and sit with those things. This week, I heard two things that helped me center today's exploration and kind of focus down on this series a little bit. The first was an interview with the well-known novelist and essayist Salman Rushdie. I was driving when I heard this. That's not unusual. You've heard me talk about this experience before. So if somebody else heard this part of the interview differently or feels like I'm misrepresenting it, please let me know. This is my recollection. It was late in the interview, and the show host asked Rushdie about his abiding interest in ancient mythology. And Rushdie replied that he didn't think that mythologies stick around by accident, but that they endure for a reason, and that the most likely reason that stories stay with us as a species is because they remain instructive, that they have some lesson to teach that we either still need to learn or that we seem to need to relearn over and over again. In illustrating his answer, I thought he was pretty generous with his choice of examples. He included things like the music of the Beatles, which he used to make the point that the good stuff sticks around. He also pointed out that the same stories, the same mythologies, can be viewed in very different ways, and cited an example of a story that could suggest either that love conquers death or that love is conquered by death. Same story. I thought that was a rather wise and important observation about the nature of these enduring stories. So that was one experience that I had. The second experience was an ad that showed up in my inbox from a company that makes visual resources for exploring belief, with a particular emphasis on art making. Some of you might recall, it's a few years ago now, but you might recall us being invited as a community to color in some large banners during a talky bit. That's that same company. This particular ad was for an upcoming series that they have created that they are calling Where Does It Hurt? Now, if you're a parent or if you've hung out with younger kids, you know what it's like maybe to you look away from the kid for a moment or the kids for a moment and you hear a kid go down in a heap behind you and you turn around because they make a noise, they cry out, and you don't know specifically what happened and you ask that question, where does it hurt? And we ask because we care, right? I mean, we might also ask because we're freaking out inside and we're sort of holding our breath. We're hoping the kid's just going to, you know, point to their skinned knee and not be, you know, holding their arm with their jacket sleeve in a strange shape, you know. Sorry if that was too graphic and anybody has, you know, traumatic childhood bike accident memories or something. I do. The point is that it's a caring thing to ask, where does it hurt, right? And we're fine doing it with our wounded littles, but we're less likely to do it with our struggling not-so-littles. And somewhere along the way, it seems like maybe many of us have gotten the message that you just don't do that. You don't ask another adult, where does it hurt? And maybe if you're a professional or assigned designated kind of caregiver, you ask that, but, you know, not generally. But right now, these days, I think there are a lot of us that feel like we're falling down and hurting ourselves, or we're getting pushed over by circumstances and we're being wounded in the process. And that's sort of the personal part. Also, we are surrounded by people that we love that are in pain, that are hurting, and we can tell. Some of them are hurting bad enough to talk about it, right? I also got an email this past week from an online mental health resource that I'm connected with. They were offering a session to help people evaluate where they are at with alcohol use or abuse at this point in the pandemic. And this particular online mental health resource was offering this sort of seminar or workshop because they were hearing from so many people who were saying something along the lines of, this is an area where the hurt is showing up for me. This is an area where I can tell that I'm wailing on the inside and I don't know what to do about it except to consume more and more of what numbs that pain for a while. So we're hurting. Lots of us are hurting. And sometimes we don't even feel all that clear about the particulars. It might be relatively simple to answer the question, why are you hurting, by pointing to a particular event, you know, a trauma or a loss or a big shift of some kind in our lives. Or in lieu of such specificity, we can sort of just gesture toward the pandemic and say, that, you know, that's why I'm hurting. And goodness knows, that might be all the explanation we need. But sometimes, even when the mechanism of injury, as I was taught to call it as a paramedic, even when the mechanism of injury is easy to see, the wound isn't. We don't always bleed most or worst on the outside. In situations like that, where it might not be so easy to kind of go cause-effect, we might need some diagnostic clues to figure out what's causing the pain. And one important category of clues are enduring stories, because as a species, we tend to make instructive stories about the exact places where we are experiencing pain. Stories that point to where we're hurting, explain why we're hurting, and offer a way forward. Now, if we grew up around religion, I'm going to say pretty much any religion, we grew up surrounded by stories that did those things. In lots of cases, we also grew up under the instruction of folks that could weave those stories together into interlocking systems of belief or worldviews, ways of understanding what was going on inside of us, between us, around us. And that is very powerful stuff. Now, this isn't exclusive to religion, of course. A set of scientific explanations can have that same kind of power in our lives, for example. This is one way, by the way, this is one way to view the rise of the soft sciences, things like psychology, the sciences that sometimes find it difficult to come up with supporting data using the scientific method as we understand and apply it in the Western world, but that still offer compelling explanations for what we're experiencing. Our drive to make meaning will move us to push the boundaries of pretty much any worldview in the interest of being able to understand what we're going through. When we grow up with or are deeply impacted by a set of stories that feel like they offer an explanation for an often puzzling and sometimes painful world, when we hit a place like that, we tend to camp out there. Our human drive to make meaning of this world and our experiences in it seems to be pretty much baked in. It's a drive that's so strong that we'll often even take a bad explanation or an indefensible one, or one that if we start to examine it immediately sort of creates dissonance for us. We'll take an explanation like that over no explanation pretty often. And more than a few of us, in the midst of the experience of soaking in a particular set of explanatory stories, were also taught that whatever worldview we were imbibing was the only one that was true, or the only one that could save us, or the only one that could save all of humanity, and that departing from any of the tenets that supported that worldview meant that we would lose not only our sort of access to or place in that whole system, but all the good things that came with it, perhaps including our very soul. So when we started to hurt in ways that used to be soothed by those stories, when we came to them for reassurance and comfort and for healing, and we did that, we came to them for those things, and then we found that we couldn't believe some of them anymore, or that we had learned things that made that more difficult to do, we were not only hurting from life, but now we were also tossed into the maelstrom of doubt. Guiding stories are powerful, and we need them. Guiding stories are often enduring stories. Enduring stories have survived for a long time for many reasons, one important one being their ability to be understood in more than one way. But that's not an aspect of those stories that tends to be emphasized when we're learning them, when they're being taught to us. In the early going, what tends to get emphasized is the this is true part, the this explains that part. And that can make it pretty tough to know how to proceed when we encounter some belief or explanation that used to work for us and we realize that we now doubt it. Maybe we can imagine that experience, that moment of doubt, as being on a bit of a continuum. Let's say at one side of that continuum is the experience where we kind of realize that's what's happening for us, and it's kind of like, huh, that's interesting. Maybe I'll think about that later. You know, it doesn't run that deep, right? So that's one end. And it's kind of a twinge. And at the other end of a continuum like this, we might find panic or despair, sort of the I'm headed straight for the hottest level of hell, you know, kind of an experience, right? Of course, lots of us don't believe in hell anymore, but some of us can still remember the conundrum of wondering if stopping believing in such a story meant that we were headed there. How's that for confusing? Anyway, in a community like this one, where exploring what we believe is the norm, the message, get your beliefs right or perish, is not the gold standard. The gold standard is doing the necessary work to make a space safe for exploring what we believe. And so, as part of doing that work, I want to spend a few weeks unpacking the importance of doubt in that kind of a process. I believe that it is impossible to explore what we believe without doubt coming into the experience. In fact, I would go so far as to say that doubt is usually the instigator of these explorations. Doubt about the veracity of a story or a particular perspective on a story, doubt about a doctrine or a dogma, doubt about the explanation of who we are and what our experiences mean, doubt about the mysteries we sense but can't get a solid grip on, doubt about beliefs we once maybe not only espoused but may have vigorously and thoughtfully defended or imposed on others, quite aggressively in some cases. Arguably, imposing a belief system aggressively on others is one lens through which to understand something like residential schools. I could go on with examples, but the common denominator of this experience of exploring what we believe in circumstances like the ones that I was just mentioning illustratively, the common denominator would be doubt. Some of us have been taught in no uncertain terms that doubt is categorically a huge problem. To experience doubt is to be at best on dangerous moral or spiritual ground. To doubt is to put yourself in the kind of place where you might get out alive, but but only if you turn around. That's what repent means, right? Only if you turn around and you head back toward the solid ground of certainty immediately. In many settings, to express doubt is to experience being regarded askance, being aggressively questioned, being moved to the margins of community as a less trustworthy person. It can mean being shunned. It can mean being fired. It can feel like putting everything on the line. So, not surprisingly, I would say, some of us still have kind of a tape loop playing in our minds and hearts that says that doubt is bad. That doubt is the enemy of all things good, that it's the opposite of faith, or that it's the opposite of passionate, life-altering belief. And if we experience it, we should run to the nearest representative of certainty and get ourselves sorted out before we start to unbelieve something essential or start to believe something outside the pale. I don't know how many of you were around last Sunday when Anna told part of her story about how she felt emotionally the first few times she went to yoga class. My recollection is that she talked about this during and lunch after, not during the actual sort of talky bit time slot. This story might not make much sense to anyone that didn't grow up around all things with linkages to Eastern religions are a deadly evil kind of message, you know, but Anna did. So even though her own journey as a person, as a thoughtful, conscientious, spiritually conscientious adult, even though her own journey in those things had taken her to a place where she no longer found that idea that anything that might have come from the East or from outside of Western Christianity was evil and deadly, even though she didn't find that believable, she still talked about, when she told that story, about actually feeling a bit ill the first few times that she went to yoga, as if she was sort of waiting for, she talked about waiting for the devil to kind of come and get her for doing such a terrible thing as practicing yoga. Well, that's a for instance, a fairly specific one to be sure, but a for instance of how the terrain of doubt can feel. It can feel like we've found ourselves somewhere we were always told we should never go. And we're kind of terrified. But also, we have learned things that we can't unlearn. We have seen things that we can't unsee. And even though we might find ourselves in a moment of doubt, feeling afraid to move forward, to examine that doubt, to examine what has provoked that doubt, to examine the thing we are doubting, even though we feel afraid to move into that, we know that we cannot go back without being conscious of being disingenuous. That to go back and behave a belief we no longer believe is to be duplicit. It's to say one thing and do another. It's to enact something that is not true to us. And that can be a terrible intersection. Awkward doesn't begin to cover it. If what I just described arrived on the doorstep of your self carrying a huge basket of guilt with it just now, sort of that feeling of, oh God, I'm doing that every time I go home for, you know, Christmas dinner and I sit at my parents' table and the conversation gets religious. I am enacting a character that is not true to me, or something like that. That's a frequently cited, you know, example, so that's why I chose it. I want to say, to the degree that I can say this to anybody and have it be, have merit, I want to say that I hope you can put that basket of guilt down and leave it sitting there while you explore this together with us. I don't think there's anybody who has grown up inside a hegemonic system of belief or system of belief that says this is it. This is the one. This is the truth. This is the way, the truth, and the life. This view of these stories, this understanding of the world, this set of creeds, whatever it is. I don't think anybody who's grown up inside of a system like that can doubt it and suddenly feel like they have clarity about how to express those doubts or what they mean, or to sift them all down into a different view of the world, and then just kind of stand up and go, here I am with my new fully formed, you know. This is pretty dynamic, fluid stuff. It really is. And again, not exclusive to religion. I'm illustrating it primarily from that because when we at the table talk about exploring what we believe, we've got enough shared context to know that we're often talking about these worldview kinds of things, and we're often talking about them in the setting of our spiritual beliefs and our spiritualities being examined and formed. So I'll keep illustrating that way. But I could illustrate this by telling a story of an executive or a CEO sitting in their corner office considering something that they have just seen about a sweatshop that their company uses that they were unaware of or in denial about before, and having it sink down into their soul in a different way and going, I have run my whole life. I have prioritized, I have trained, I have learned, I have proselytized, I have been an evangelist for free market capitalism at any cost, believing it's the way forward for humanity. And right now, right here in my power seat, I doubt it. Who are you going to tell, CEO? you're going to tell your vice presidents first? You're going to tell your shareholders? You're going to go home and tell your family, I quit. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I can't do this anymore. All just to say, there's lots of stories where we can come to these points, you know, where we can be like, well, I don't think I can go back. I don't think I can go back to what I believe, but I don't really know how to go forward. What I know is that thing that I was solid about before, I doubt it. That intersection that I'm trying to illustrate, that is the intersection at which I want to propose and then explore an alternative to the idea that doubt is a problem, that doubt is our enemy, that doubt is the enemy of even of things like what we often might use a word like faith for. I want to suggest that not only is doubt not categorically a problem, but that it's actually essential to exploring what we believe. I want to suggest that doubt is a catalyst, a lubricant, a counterweight, a shifter of lenses on whatever it is that we're pondering, whatever it is that we're learning, whatever it is that we're encountering. I want to suggest that doubt is not essential the way, you know, a jack is essential when you have a flat tire. Doubt is not like a tool that you only take out when you've got a problem to solve. I want to suggest that doubt is essential like oxygen is essential. Like we need doubt to feel alive. We need doubt to thrive. That if we don't have doubt, we don't have exploration. If we don't have exploration, we don't have evolution. If we don't have evolution, we're on a path toward entropy, toward decline, toward eventually just sort of stalling and collapsing. How's that for an all or nothing system of belief, hey? Let me temper that with two things. One is I read a quote from someone this week who said that if they wrote a book of theology, the last sentence in the book would be, or something like that. Given that the person who said that was a working theologian, I thought that's a good idea. I can take that to heart, or something like that. One of my colleagues at the university liked to use the phrase "our notions about God." Remember the first time I heard them say that, I was like, "Well, that's lodged in me for the rest of my life, in a good way." So that's one thing. The other thing is just very briefly to circle back to this Kamloops discovery for a moment. I was, as the world was and is, horrified. I did not feel surprised. And that's a horrific thing to acknowledge in itself. But I didn't. I was grieved. I was sad. I was repulsed. I did not wish to be associated in any way with any institution by any name that would behave that way in the name of its beliefs about what it also claimed was a good divinity, a good God. So I had all those emotions. And then I saw a picture online of the one of the buildings at that school, the large reddish brick sort of central building. Some of you have seen this picture, I expect. It's a common one to go with the headlines. And there was something about the substance of that building, about its weight in the world, the amount of dollars it would have cost to make that building, the amount of human energy that would have had to be committed to maintaining it, staffing it, driving its ideology forward, filling it with children who were also you know, ripped from their families, also something that takes human focus and energy and determination and belief. You don't go rip a child away from their family unless you believe something about what you're doing, or you're pathological. You're able to suspend all that stuff. You've got a clinical issue, if you will. There was something about seeing that photograph of that building that coalesced some of my doubts, that made me think that whatever it is that I say that I believe, that spirit of, or something like that, open to doubt, if you will, needs to be present in there, so that in moments like that one, and many others, I don't recoil from doubt. I don't back away, kind of going, uh-oh, here comes big bad doubt, time to retreat. Nope, I don't need to do that. We don't need to do that. So it's in that spirit, that, or something like that spirit, that I would like us to spend some time exploring doubt. Not because we're afraid of it and we want to make it go away, but because we want to explore what we believe, and that means we need to get to know doubt better. That we need to learn how to make doubt our companion, even our beloved companion. That might sound like a crazy idea, depending where you're coming from, but even our beloved companion on the journey. I'm looking forward to this. I hope that by way of an introduction, that can help us all look forward to these next explorations. So we can learn how to walk through a beautiful world with doubt as part of that journey, not as a necessary reparative tool, but as one that fills us with the things that help us to thrive. Peace.